Meandering in the margins of medicine, it's the Short Code Podcast.
Welcome to the Short Code Podcast. I'm Dave Etler, and more importantly, I'm here with students Kurt Wall, Miles Greenwald, and Brandon Lyle. Hi, gentlemen.
Hello.
And we have some special guests here today, too. Dr. Denny and Nurse Paula Lofstrom are a pair of, I think it would be accurate to call you medical missionaries.
Correct.
Who have spent many years traveling the world from places like, or to places like the Antarctic, Guatemala, Tanzania. I guess it's hard to do a medical mission in Antarctica, but maybe
we were very busy there.
Okay, fair enough.
We really weren't missionaries there.
No, we were employees.
There you go. Their journey together began, in the late 1980s when they embarked on a mission to Guatemala with a team of healthcare professionals, and it was the first of several trips to Guatemala until in the early 2000s they were asked by a colleague to visit, I think, Iambi, Tanzania in East Africa. And it was there that the Lofstroms would discover a new chapter in their mission work. In 2006, they formed International Health Partners in the U.S. and Tanzania, which works to improve health care for the people of Tanzania. Dr. and Mrs. Lofstrom, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I thought I'd start today by asking in Tanzania what it's like to be a patient there.
Busy.
Yeah.
What it's like to be a patient. I think most people that are unfamiliar with the medical process in general are scared. So what's it like? It's a scary situation. You know, it used to be that there still are a lot of people in the U.S. who say, I don't want to go to the hospital because that's where people go to die. And I think that is still a prevailing attitude in a lot of the third world. If you're desperate enough to go to a hospital, you'll probably die. That's what they feel. So I would say fear and hope.
Is this because the standard of care there is just, you know, not the...
Stinks.
Yeah. Okay. I was trying to be nice.
Well, the thing is that there are so few medical practitioners and so many patients. That when we opened the doors at a Lutheran hospital back in 1958, we were seeing, in a matter of months, we were seeing 800 to 1,200 patients a day. This was out in the boondocks, where people would come for miles to be seen.
Right. It's just, there are too few practitioners. There is not enough equipment. The medications run out. The government allots so much medication per facility per month, and it's usually gone after 10 days. So how is a doctor supposed to work?
Yeah, I definitely, in my experience in other countries, and I'm sure in Brandon's and Kurt's experience working in different countries, yeah, it definitely seems like the shortage of physicians and the shortage of equipment, and then just financially support for the hospitals is one of the biggest problems.
I remember experiencing that firsthand when I was working with you guys a couple summers ago with the doctor's strike. I don't know if there's been any fallout from that since then, but I remember for about 2 weeks all of the hospitals across the country were shut down, and hospitals like what you guys were running was basically the only source of care.
Right. What was the doctor's strike?
Know more about that.
They hadn't been paid in over 3 months.
Yeah, they hadn't been paid for at least 3 to 4 months. And of course, they all had families. They had to feed them. And it got to be a real crisis.
Right. There was no medicine, there was no equipment, and there was no money. So they were striking for better conditions for the patients.
So what are your goals then in the face of all this? What are your goals in Tanzania and elsewhere, I guess?
We try to make all of our projects self-sustaining so that when we have finished developing them, that they still will be sustained without outside donations to them.
And now we're building a pediatric hospital. There are 18 million children in Tanzania under the age of 14 and no pediatric hospital to serve them. Some larger hospitals have a pediatric department, but nowhere is there a whole hospital facility dedicated to children. A lot of hospitals just put the kids in with the adults. The other way we are addressing the situation is we now have the largest nursing school in Tanzania at St. John's University in Dodoma. We have almost 500 students in a baccalaureate level nursing program. We have a master's in nursing education program being taught long distance by 6 PhD nurses from the U.S. And we have just been approved to start a laboratory tech school under the nursing department at St. John's. And so, of course, we feel education is the way to touch the future because of Dr. Kitundu's reputation, and Dr. Yesi Kitundu will be the doctor in charge of this hospital. He's taught the pediatric residency program at Muhimbili, the big teaching hospital, for about 20, 25 years. And this hospital is his dream. And the Ministry of Health is anxious for our doors to get open so that they can start a pediatric residency program at our facility run by Dr. Kitundu.
Do you feel in some way that the government, it almost sounds like the government is a little bit dependent upon your hospital. Do you feel like that is true at all?
Absolutely. When the First Lady came to lay the foundation stone and the people from the Ministry of Health came, they said, oh, we've been waiting for years for somebody to help us with this, and now you've come. And they don't have money, but they want to support us in every way that they can.
What would you say have been some of the biggest challenges, culturally, financially, or just logistics-wise, in building the new hospital?
Well, it's always a matter of money. Yeah, we are often asked, how soon will it be finished? And we have to say, that depends upon where and when the money comes. And that is the limiting factor in it. We could have the hospital up and running in less than 12 months.
Two months.
Well,
If we had
all the money.
If we had $53,000, we could open in a couple of months, open the first building.
That would be the first unit, which is a large outpatient clinic building. It's 109 feet long, 32 feet wide, has 10 rooms and 4 bathrooms. We could designate those rooms for various aspects of a hospital and open it as a small hospital to begin with, until we could get the wards and the administration building and the birthing center and the surgery built. But they wouldn't take long, because we build only on one layer, as you know, one story, because we've got plenty of room. We want the breezes through the hospital wards to keep them cool. You don't have to have air conditioning. And if the electricity goes out, nobody gets caught in the elevator. It's all on one level with covered corridors.
When the First Lady came, she asked, what are your challenges? And we said, number one, it's the roads, because the road coming off the main highway is about a mile, and it's really, really just tracks. Another was our internet service is so poor that I can't even upload pictures, but at least I do have internet. And the third one was electricity. And we had asked about electricity several months ago, and the Tanesco, the electric company, wanted more money than we had in order to bring it to us. And when we explained our situation to the First Lady, then about a month ago, I suppose now, maybe even 5 weeks ago, this truckload of guys comes to the site and said, somebody from the government said we're supposed to bring electricity to this hospital. We said, oh, really? So then Selimani Shabani, our project manager, went and talked to the manager at Tanesco, and they said, how big of a transformer do you want? And we said 200 kV. And they said, you know, they counted out the poles, and we've seen the poles be delivered from a truck into the village. And so prior to this, when we brought when IHP brought electricity to Iambi Hospital, it cost us $1,000 a pole to bring it in. And so we said, this time, how much is it going to cost us? And they said, it's not.
Well, there you go. I was struck, looking at the website, I was struck by the, you know, there's a wish list on your website, and I was struck by the things that you're wishing for. And they're not things like, I mean, I suppose that these are all things that you need, but they're not, the things that you listed weren't things like, you know, medicine or equipment or like medical equipment, but they were things like bricks and diesel fuel. These are pretty, you know,
basic things. We have a generator of 50 kV, but it takes 8 gallons an hour.
No, it takes 8 liters, eight or nine liters per hour.
To run. And that's too expensive for us to tolerate. So we only use it when it's absolutely necessary.
And I can't remember where I read it, but I think it was per gallon. Diesel is close to $9 a gallon.
Well, it's about $8
a gallon. $8 a gallon. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's, I mean,
that's a big expense for us. And
what sort of independence of electricity do you have?
Well, right now we have solar. But the solar is very expensive to put in, and the quality of light isn't terrific. Now, we have solar at our house, but it's not enough to run the printer. Okay, but we have light enough at night that we can read. But it's, you know, solar is expensive to put in, and you don't get a lot of oomph for it. For instance, I don't think you could get enough solar to run an x-ray machine.
What are some of the most valuable lessons that you guys have taken away from your past experiences building healthcare centers at different places that have informed your approach to this new one at Bagamoyo?
For our unit to be able to make our own decisions, having no one tell us that we have to do this or we can't do that. But the only thing that we really have to toe the mark on is all government regulations, and we do that.
Mm-hmm. But the standards we have are so far above the government standards that we don't need to worry much about that. But we do comply with all the government rules. But yes, being an independent NGO, we can make our own decisions and choose what's the best way to do things to serve the patient population.
Was that a large, I guess, driving force in wanting to form your own NGO, to be independent and be able to, you know, make those decisions that affect patient care and yourselves?
Absolutely, and also to be to qualify for a lot of grants, you need to be. In the U.S., you need to be a 501c3, which is a nonprofit corporation or charitable corporation. And then in Tanzania, we are what's called an NGO or non-government organization. And that gives us the same tax-exempt status in both countries, which means like when we bring in a container of medical supplies, we don't have to pay customs on that to Tanzania.
How have you felt that it's been working with other NGOs in the area? Has it been more helpful or more frustrating than?
Well, we've had, we've joined with Jesse Kitundu's NGO, and that has worked out marvelously. It's been a real good fit. We have taken things that we know, and he has been developing his NGO for quite a long time. In fact, his NGO started buying the land where we are now building the children's hospital. And that has worked out very well.
But as far as any other NGO, no, we don't work with any other NGO.
You feel like there are others in the area that are trying to do similar work where a coordinated approach could be helpful?
Not that I know of, Kurt.
Yeah. There was a Korean.
No, that was a GEO. It wasn't an NGO.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Right. I don't know of anyone. NGOs don't build hospitals because it's so hard and so expensive. And so when you say someone else doing what we're doing, we're the only ones doing it.
I think that kind of highlights the difference between a place like Tanzania, where any help is so valuable, as opposed to a place like Haiti, where there's just been this outpouring of aid, but it's all very uncoordinated and sometimes getting in the way of each other.
That could be. We haven't had that traffic in our area.
And speaking in some of the help that you are looking for or need, what do you feel like are some of the best ways in which medical students, like when Kurt came, what were the best practices for them to do, or how do you feel like they help when they do come and visit?
Well, I think probably Kurt could answer that from his own viewpoint. From our viewpoint, we think that we have Dr. Bond, who's a real gem of a Tanzanian physician, and he has been invaluable to our program.
I think as a younger medical student, pretty much anywhere you go in a foreign setting, you're going to be getting more out of the experience than you're going to be contributing, just because you learn so much every day being in a setting like that. But just finding little ways to contribute, just helping the doctors and the nurses and other healthcare workers with their daily routine tasks, and just sort of going along with the flow and enjoying yourself and creating a good atmosphere.
When Denny's daughter was going to have surgery out in Arizona, and you know how the anesthesiologist comes in and talks to the patient and the family, and then he went outside, and so I hooked him, you know, and told him what we do, and then I said, "So, do you want to come out and play?" And he said, "Yes, actually I do." Because as a medical student, I went to Kenya, and I always told myself I wanted to go back when I could really do something, and you're the first one that's asked. Mm. And so I feel that by opening a wider world to the medical students, we may not be helping just ourselves. You know, yeah, we want you to come back and help us. But what we're doing is turning on young students to the fact that there's a big, wide world out there, and there's a lot you can do because the need is just incredible. So I think it's a symbiotic relationship. Yes, we like having the students, your extra hands for us, but then we're also teaching and giving back.
I have a question for you, Kurt. So as somebody who's been out there doing this, had you always wanted to do this? What was your motivation for doing this? Or was it something that somebody said, "Hey, you should do this," and you were like, "Oh, okay"?
I can't say that it was something that I'd always dreamed about doing, actually. When I got to medical school, I didn't really have any intention of being involved with global health. But I kind of got exposed to it early, thankfully, and became more and more interested in it. And then I think that first summer after my first year, when I went to stay with Paula and Denny, that was kind of the turning point for me when I realized that it's something that I really want to be involved with going forward.
So this is not just something that you did while in medical school, and you know, you're going to
continue
for a long doing time. This.
Absolutely. And I think that just perfectly demonstrates what Paula was just saying, that you know, when you go your first as an early medical student, you may not be able to contribute that much. But it's you can view it as an investment in students, and hopefully, even if they don't come back to that same location, they get addicted to global health and will be better prepared to go anywhere they want to in the future, and more likely to go somewhere in the future.
I also think it sharpens the skills of the medical students not to have all the bells and whistles that are available here. You have to rely more on your clinical skills and on your history taking. One of the schools where we've had students from, they said what they notice, for instance, is that students that haven't had a third world experience, next semester we have to take pathology. And the ones that have been out, it's like, oh, next year we get to take pathology. So it's an attitudinal shift on the parts of the students, I think.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back in just a second on the Short Code Podcast.
Inside Stories is an oral narratives project that catalogs the stories of medical students during their journeys through medical school. The podcast is hosted on In Training, the online magazine for medical students. Visit us at in-training.org/inside-stories. Inside Stories is a founding member of Vocalis, the podcast network for medical students. Please listen to our partner podcasts at vocalisnetwork.wix.com/listen.
So you mentioned just the challenge, the immense challenge that fundraising is. Can you talk a little bit about fundraising and what your experience with it has been and even how it's changed over the years, or if it's changed?
Well, we've been working at that, and we do it on a rotational basis. Paula and I come to the States 3 to 4 months out of the year to do fundraising. Then the rest of the time we go back and we work on our construction and designing of the hospital and all. So it's been a learning experience, and we have traveled how many miles?
Well, last year we put 53,000 miles on the van, but I would say our fundraising has evolved equipment-wise, whereas we used to use where you put transparencies on a machine, and now we have a PowerPoint. I have found if we tell the story of what we're doing and people see the need, I don't really have to ask for money. It's more people saying, how can I help? And then I let them have it. But certainly the fundraising involves having people trust you and trust what you do, which is another benefit to us from having medical students, medical teams come out, because then they can testify that what we are doing, we are really responsible with handling the money, and that we're spending it wisely, that we're good stewards of people's donations to us. And that's a benefit for us, and then helps the fundraising for the next time.
And that's another thing I noticed on your website was sort of the breakdown of, you know, very little of what you're taking in goes to administrative costs and things like that. Something like 95% of it goes to the actual needs there on the ground.
That's true. Well, we're all volunteers.
Sure.
Us old people, and then we pay our Tanzanian staff. But Denny, Mary Ellen, Joyce, and I are all just living on our Social Security. So, and we don't have any offices, so we're not paying rent. We're not paying anything for administration, other than we have to pay the auditor. We have to pay the gas to get us around. We have to pay contracts, certain contracts, and that's it. The rest all goes into doing what we're saying we're doing.
And fortunately, now we have younger people that are coming in as volunteers, and they're going to take over for Paula and I as we get older. And we have teaching staff. We have a neonatologist and a pediatrician husband and wife team that are going to be coming out in about 2 years to be the teaching staff also. So it's an ongoing program.
What do you feel like have been some of the keys to creating a sustainable program or a sustainable hospital? You talk about the young people coming up. And
Well, the self-sustaining means money. Okay. And the way we do that is we have the pharmacy on one bank account and the running budget on another bank account, and never the twain shall meet, because in too many facilities, when they don't have enough money for the salaries for the employees, then they borrow it from the pharmacy account, and pretty soon there's not enough money to run the pharmacy. Patients figure out there's not enough medicine there, so they don't bother going there, and then the whole thing spirals down and out. So just from a practical nuts and bolts way to do it, we have the pharmacy, we charge 10% over the wholesale cost of the drugs. With that 10% profit, we pay the nurse pharmacist, and we buy things like syringes and gloves and so forth. And that money is separate. Then the operating account has its own money. And if, let's say in December sometimes, the patient visits go down and there may not be enough money to cover the salaries, then they just don't get their whole salary that month. That's just a fact, Jack. But we try and we run it on the razor's edge financially because we don't want to make a profit. We are a nonprofit. But we charge the patients enough so that we can have, we can pay the staff salaries, we can pay for the laundry soap, we can pay for the cleaning supplies, and we have just enough profit set aside so that if the donated equipment breaks, that we can afford to replace it with new equipment.
How have you felt that you've been able to manage or work with the employees when you aren't able to pay them, or how does that work?
That only happened once, and we told them they'd have to get out there and help us make more money. And so what they'd started doing then was they went to some private schools. They went to two Catholic schools, a Muslim school, and a couple of just
mission schools.
Yeah, mission. What did I say? The Catholic, the Independent, and the Muslims. And they said, all right, we will treat your students, which were boarding students, and come talk to us about a contract. And so they did, and we do. And it increased the patient load enough that they never had to go again without having their full salary.
It's kind of a blessing in disguise,
and
it sounds like.
And then it helped also that we got the Serengeti Brewery under our wing and did all of the work for their employees, which were about 290?
No, 256, I think. But we did all the pre-employment physicals. We did some outreach down there. We taught. We put like little Red Cross stations throughout the brewery so that if there were an emergency, there would be people to handle it. They sent people to us when they were sick. And then, of course, when people are accustomed to coming to us for good care, then they started bringing their own families to us. So you work at increasing your business just like any business.
You mentioned the importance of education and that trying to make an impact in that regard. What would you say, contrasting the education system here in America to the education, the medical education system there? What would you say are the biggest similarities or differences?
Well, that's a big question. They don't have enough people that go through secondary school. Not everybody can go to secondary school because of the cost. So you have a whole raft of people that have had a seventh grade education, and they're out in the workforce, and you have only, what,
2%? 20% of the people get to go to high school. Very, very few get to go to university or to medical school. They did increase the size of the medical school. I think it was from 120 to 240 students a year for the country. And they had their applications went up from 10,000 to 30,000 for those spots. So the facilities for teaching and the teachers to do the teaching are the limiting factors, in addition to the lack of equipment.
Yeah. The infrastructure of the African countries are very low, is very low. It needs to be elevated in all aspects. Clean water, electricity, more schools available for higher education across the board, actually.
If you were to have a group of medical students, a larger group than three ahead of you right now, what would be advice for them in terms of preparing to do global health work, whether on a short-term or long-term basis? Just a couple of...
Be flexible. Don't go in with a preconceived notion of what you are going to do. One issue we've had, particularly with nursing students, with young graduates of nursing, they have the feeling that they're going to come into a clinic and show us how to do things, show the African staff how to do things, when they have been doing the best they could with what they had for many, many years. So as a guest or as a student going in, you have to be there knowing that you're going to learn more than you're going to teach. But it's also wonderful to have that relationship where you both teach and learn. And our staff are always anxious to learn from our visiting medical students and doctors and so forth. And also, we have our medical students go into the schools and do teaching. And I think you learn as much when you're teaching as when you're a student.
So I'm very glad we've gotten to talk about the work you guys have done and are doing, and giving you guys the chance to impart some wisdom. But you guys also have some incredible stories. I remember some of my most favorite evenings when I was with you guys were just sitting around the dinner table and listening to you guys share stories. Do you have any favorites that come to mind that you'd like to
tell? You mean like medical stories or like Denny hunting elephants? Yeah.
Paula, when we have new people, she says, why don't you tell the elephant stories?
Well, or tell the warthog story, or tell about Stan
This is from the ancient history back in 1958 to 1962, when we had to supply the hospital and the nursing school and the Augustana Missionary Kids School with meat. So you had to go out every weekend and get 5 animals. We had a special license from the government. And you had to have 5 of those. Now, that's terrible duty to be assigned, to have to go out every other weekend and hunt 5 animals. I really enjoyed it. One time we were out on the Kodiak Plains. This is down below the hospital where we were at Kiamboy, and not too far away, actually. And you hunt by driving down onto the plains, park your car, and then you circle out from that to get the game. And there are usually 2 vehicles, and we stayed usually about maybe 10 miles apart. And when you went down, and then we'd hunt around. And as you know, when twilight comes in Tanzania, darkness isn't far away. And I got caught out one time away from either of the vehicles, and it got dark. And you can't see much at all. And I was listening and walking towards the car and towards the Land Rover, and I heard this rustling in the grass, and I said, boy, I'm in trouble, because there was a herd of warthogs that were out ruffling around. And the warthog has teeth that come out to the side, and when they charge you, they hit you and cut you with those tusks on it. And I could just barely see through this, so I had to get way down on the ground so I could get against the horizon to see where these animals were coming from. And lo and behold, one of the big boars see me, and he came right towards me. And of course, I had my .375 Magnum Winchester, and I fortunately dropped him just about 1 foot ahead of my head. He came charging, and I got him. And we had warthog meat that time. So, yeah.
2 birds with 1 stone there. I mean, saved your life and provided your...
Right.
Tell them about the visiting pastors that came out to go hunting.
Okay. We always had a delegate of pastors that wanted to come out to, quote, view the mission work out there. Of course, that was a vacation for them. So we had about 5 of them. They came out. And we have some good Italian friends, Bicchieri's, Marco, who is a real comedian. And Marco and I and Stan Morris, another of the doctors, went out with these 6 pastors that came out. And we had given them rifles because they wanted to shoot some game. So we got down on the plains, and the animals were out there about 100, 200 yards away. And we said, okay, you get out of the car, you go along the road, you don't shoot from the car, but there's your targets, and you drop them. So these six pastors got out, and they were standing along there, and they were shooting, and they were shooting, and they were shooting.
Bang, nothing bang, banging dropping. Away.
Nothing dropped. And Marco Bicchieri was up on top of the Land Rover watching, and I was down on the hood, and he looked down and he said, Wageni wana funzi nyama siogopi bunduki. The visitors are teaching the animals not to be afraid of guns.
Do you have any cool Antarctica stories?
Oh,
they're pretty cool, all right. Yeah, I got I got frostbite about the first week we were out there.
He got what was it, your right foot, right? The front half of his right foot got frostbitten.
Because every time they went out on a what they call a boondock trip, they had to have a medical personnel with them. And so I was on a snowmobile with some very good nurse driver who obviously had a lot of experience, much more than I had. And I was sitting on this, and we were traveling along, and of course, it's 40 to 50 below zero. And I noticed that my boot was not tight on my leg. And I had, you inflate them so that you have a air barrier on it. And that had dissipated. And so my foot was getting colder and colder and colder. And we were traveling about 20 miles. Now we got back to base, and I got into base, and we warmed it up. But it was very, very cold on that one trip.
We found out later that when the weather changes like that and you're on a snowmobile, the passenger's supposed to turn around and face the back instead of the front. But she didn't tell him that.
To protect from the wind?
Yeah, from the wind, yeah. We were there about... Well, we were there from fully light through fully dark up to fully light. And one time we were watching a pod of emperor penguins out on the ice. And when the supply ship comes in, it cuts the ice up. It breaks the ice up. And so the minke whales and the orca whales come in through that broken up ice. And
they lay up on the ice.
Yeah. And so I was watching these penguins out there, and this big old orca comes bash right through the ice and grabs one of those penguins and shakes it and kills it. And then just very, very, very slowly slides back into the ocean.
Wow, that's amazing.
I was looking and I asked the other people in Prairie Lap, did you see that? And they said, no, you're hogging the binoculars.
Oh. And we later heard that no scientist had ever seen an orca whale take a penguin.
So then we knew I didn't count.
Oh, man. Well, I want to thank you both for joining us this week. This has been really interesting talking to you and hearing your stories and hearing about Tanzania. How can people help if they hear this and want to help?
Well, you've mentioned our website, which is www.ihptz.org. We invite you to go to the website, and by the way, it is being redone now. You can donate on the website. You can donate to our work. You can come out and volunteer. You don't have to be medical. We've had medical students bring their parents out, and that's been fun, too. But certainly we have had lots and lots of visitors who have helped us, and I believe changed their own lives. And so
We have had about a team of volunteers each month that we've been there. And we have a job for everybody.
Sounds like it. Yeah. A lot of work.
Mm-hmm. A lot of work.
Well, fantastic. Thank you so much for joining us. And thank you to you gentlemen as well, Kurt Wall, Miles Greenwald, and Brandon Lyle. Thanks so much. Yeah. All right. Thanks for listening to the Short Code Podcast. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to tell us about your moment of truth. If something strange or wonderful happened to you, if you're annoyed or pleased about something, or if you'd like to say hi to that special basic science professor in your life, leave us a message at theshortcode.com. Do follow us on Twitter so you can stay up to date on what's happening at the margins of medicine. The show is made possible by this strange world we live in and a generous donation by Carver College of Medicine Student Government and the Writing and Humanities Program. Special thanks this week to the Global Medicine Society. Our executive producers are Dave Etler and Jason Lewis. Our opening theme is by Dude Skywalker, and our closing music is by C2C. Talk to you in a week.